Roger Griffiths here, the publisher of The Hub. Welcome to our regular Friday roundtable. Before I do anything on this show, I just have to thank all the amazing Hub fellows that have come forward over the past week to support our journalism and commentary with a lifetime membership at $500. Hugely generous. They get all the benefits and perks of subscription forever. And trust me, we've got The Hub geared up to be around forever. So a big thank you to Bradley P, Catherine L, Derek B, Dustin W, Greg P, Marie R, Melissa C, Stuart O, and Tyler S. Thank you all so much for becoming Hub Fellows, and thank you all the rest of you listening who have become Hub subscribers over the last week. Again, your support is greatly appreciated. Let me bring Sean Spear, our editor-at-large, onto the program now and welcome him.
Great to be with you as always, Roger.
Well, Sean, I think the audience deserves to know just how little faith you had earlier in the week when you and I were talking about the Leafs and their prospects. And you said, Rudyard, don't get your hopes up. This is going to one place. It's going to a loss. There will be no Game 7. And what happened, Sean? We're in Game 7, and you were wrong.
Don't get ahead of yourself here, Roger. There's a good chance that the Leafs are just toying with us, as they have over the years. But last night was an exciting game, and I admit that I've opened a crack of the door to the possibility that they might win Game 7 and move to the second round. The challenge, of course, for those listeners who follow hockey closely, the Florida Panthers are waiting on the other side of that door for us, and they made pretty easy work of the Leafs last year and looked pretty good in a first-round victory over the Tampa Bay Lightning. So what's behind door number two may not be that enticing. But it's a very long way of saying, yes, I'll be watching on Saturday night, and yes, I concede that part of me will be hopeful that this is the time that they prove me wrong.
Yeah, so listeners, this is what you hear from a diehard Leafs fan, tempered by the reality of no Stanley Cup in half a century. It is a thin brew of optimism that is stewing up here on the hot stove of the Spear household. So, Sean, we'll watch. We'll talk next week. Maybe the Panthers are next. Maybe they're not. But let's begin with another brouhaha and a hot stove that was Ottawa and Parliament this week. And, you know, this has been kicked around a lot, obviously, in the media, the various slags and slanders between the prime minister, members of his caucus, Pierre Poilievre, the leader of opposition, members of his caucus, all leading to expulsions from the House and charges against Fergus, the speaker, that he's kind of feckless and partisan. I want to get into this with you just about what it says about where the Trudeau government finds itself now, 2 short weeks after the budget, and they're already playing the white supremacist card, the white supremacist smear. What does this say to you, Sean, about the budget and where this party and prime minister now find themselves?
Yeah, I could take it in different directions. But maybe I'll start here. I really do think that the people who comprise the Trudeau government, particularly the people close to the prime minister, don't just think that Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives are wrong on different issues. I think they think they're fundamentally bad, you know, that they've convinced themselves that they're standing against the gate protecting the barbarians from coming in. And I think that type of thinking manifests itself in a couple of ways, but I think a big one is the extent to which it may be fueling the prime minister's resistance to these growing calls that he ought to resign and step down. I think if you can convince yourself that the alternative isn't, you wouldn't just take the country in a wrong direction as you see it, but in something kind of fundamentally dark, you can start to sort of self-rationalize that any and all steps along the way to prevent that, including remaining in the prime minister's role, even though the polling continues to tell us that it's moving in the wrong direction for the prime minister and his party, can as I say, can kind of lead you to do all to convince yourself of all sorts of things. And so I think that's one of the big takeaways for me here. This isn't sort of mere rhetoric, although obviously there's a rhetorical component. I you just get the sense that they've convinced themselves that Pierre Poilievre and the conservatives are something materially different than the types of conservative opponents that they've faced in the past.
The language here, Sean, from not just the prime minister, but Stephen McKinnon, the Liberal House leader, I mean, beyond hot, you know, accusing Poilievre of visiting with supporters of white supremacy, anarchy, and misogyny, the trifecta of kind of progressive sybilis on the left. I don't know. I wonder, Sean, we've talked about this before, whether, you know, this is when you kind of get down to the bottom of the barrel in terms of tactics. And we know from indeed polling that we've done at the Hub that the Trump smear, the implication that Poilievre is as bad or worse than Donald Trump as a kind of right-wing populist leader, that has some traction. Yes. With the Canadian vote in public. It's kind of the last, you know, the last thing in the store window that the Liberals have. And I just think it's revealing that, again, not 2 weeks after a budget that was supposed to supposedly turn around, you know, the narrative and the political fortune momentums of this prime minister and his party, we now have polls coming out this week that show the conservative share of vote equals that of the NDP and the Liberals, in a sense, opening up the lead over both parties. Hence, in my view, I hope, Sean, you're wrong, that this isn't ideological, that this is the whiff of desperation. And when you go to such hot language, could you imagine this happening in the British Parliament? Could you imagine, you know, in other, like, Westminster systems where we do have some remnants of like civility and decorum? I mean, this reminds me of like the Ontario provincial legislature, or, you know, what you see from the B team, the farm team of national politics. And here we have it right in our mother parliament.
Yeah. The reason why I'll make the case that I do think it's not mere tactics, that it does reflect a set of assumptions inherent not just in the Trudeau government and Liberal politics, but in the kind of adjacent voices and groups that surround Liberal politics, is if you think about the commentary, Rudyard, in the immediate aftermath of this debacle, most of it focused, of course, on Pierre Poilievre referring to the prime minister and his drug policies as wacko. There was very little commentary about the accusation that Pierre Poilievre and the conservatives are either themselves white supremacists or nodding to white supremacy. You didn't hear that, for instance, in the ruling from the speaker. You didn't hear that in a lot of the commentary that people would have read in newspapers or on television. You know, I note, for instance, a high-profile Toronto Star columnist referred to this whole episode is a part of our history, something that will go down in history as this sort of parliamentary moment. And as I say, so much of it was focused on Poilievre and not on the prime minister and the Liberals. And I interpret that in part as the kind of commentariat and the political class taking for granted that the accusation that the conservatives are themselves white supremacists or not into white supremacists is either accurate or sufficiently accurate that it need not be contested. And I think in a way that's kind of telling that this thinking, wherever it comes from, imported from the US, imported from the universities, wherever, is now just sort of part of the furniture when it comes to a lot of progressives sort of think and talk about politics.
Agreed. I continue to wonder, though, you know, does this set up a scenario that we've talked about in the past where, you know, the chasm in the polls between the Liberals and the conservatives, it's not only not shrinking, it's widening. The prime minister has clearly, you know, greenlighted at least a tentative leadership campaign by his, you know, college roommate and close personal friend, Dominic LeBlanc. Sean, this, I don't know, the budget clearly was a bust. I mean, we saw groups, you know, historically who are careful about what they say about federal budgets because they're large beneficiaries of state funding, whether that's doctors or the VC industry, turning on the Liberal Party, openly criticizing, you know, the new capital gains taxes. I don't know, Sean. I'm normally the gloomy one on this show, but I sense that there's some kind of reckoning here. I mean, how can this party and Prime Minister in particular continue on in, you know, the face of no demonstrable improvement in terms of his popularity, an economic agenda which has been largely, you know, panned, and it's causing, I think, anxiety in a variety of quarters about its profligacy and its impacts on the country's prosperity. And now, to me, it's very telling, this incredibly exaggerated rhetoric of supremacy, anarchy, and misogyny as, you know, drive-by smears on his political opponent. I mean, it's literally, Sean, I feel like it's, you know, burning down the furniture to kind of heat the house, and the prospects out of this, what's left? I mean, you kind of run out of moves. I mean, once you accuse your opponent of being a white supremacist, where do you go from there? I mean, if this doesn't move the polls, like, what's next? You'd light your hair on fire, I guess.
Yeah, the only thing I think I can add to the conversation, based on my experience in Ottawa, is I wouldn't underestimate, Rudyard, the kind of power of an us versus them narrative effectively serve as a kind of unifying or animating force for a party and a caucus that clearly is reading the polls and seeing the challenges that they're facing. There was some of that towards the end of the Harper government, a kind of circle the wagons, you know, bringing in of old hands in and around the prime minister. And as things are starting to decline, it really does sort of contribute to this this zero sum sense, this mentality about your opponents, and not just the opponents. Oftentimes, it manifests itself in criticism of the media and the business community and others. And so, one can't help but think that, you know, I'm not contradicting myself. I do think it does reflect some deep seated assumptions about conservative politics in progressive circles, but the extent to which it also creates a sort of a source of unity in a caucus that could increasingly become divided, including over whether the prime minister ought to stay, it may also have some kind of short-term political utility, if not within the Canadian public, at least within that caucus room. If you can convince your caucus members that the challenge isn't you, it's the other side who, as I say, aren't simply wrong, but are actually quite bad. You know, that may be enough to kind of keep people together. And so far, I should say, it's broadly working in the sense that we've not seen, although we've seen a lot of Liberal members announce that they don't intend to stand for election whenever it comes, including, I think, another one this week, we haven't seen a lot of Liberal MPs take pot shots at the Prime Minister. And so in that sense, it may serve some political utility for him and his office as they manage a caucus that, as I say, presumably is reading the same polls that we are.
Well put. Well, look, we're equal opportunity offenders here on the Hub Roundtable. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back on the other side and, take a hard look at a scalding op-ed published end of week by Pierre Polyev in the National Post. The title: Memo to Corporate Canada, fire your lobbyists, ignore politicians, go to the people. Sean and I are going to break this down. It's a rare instance of Pierre Polyev kind of stating some core beliefs, particularly how he thinks policy is going to get done in his government. It raises some big questions. We're going to delve into it right after this break.
You're one click away from getting access to all the Hub's best analysis and insights. Visit our website, www.thehub.ca, now and sign up for our free weekly email news digest. Every Saturday morning, we'll send to your inbox the cutting-edge thinking and analysis of our smartest contributors on the week that was. Dive into the big issues and ideas moving the public conversation, courtesy of The Hub. Again, you can grab that exclusive complimentary email newsletter right now at www.thehub.ca. Now back to our program.
Welcome back to the Hub Roundtable. Rudyard Griffiths here, the publisher of the Hub. I'm joined by Sean Speer, our editor at large. Well, Sean, we took the boots to the PM in the first half of the show, so you know we do believe in some balance, and you know, calling things out that cause us concern, or at least cause me some concern, with regard to the official leader of the opposition, Pierre Poilievre, and some of his thinking. We got a rare kind of glimpse into where his mind is at in terms of businesses, lobbyists, and public policy in Canada with an op-ed that he penned for the National Post on Friday, May 3rd. A lot to say here, Sean. I guess my worry here is just the populist vibe that runs through this, the notion that policy will be made somehow miraculously, mysteriously by the people. It will be an emanation of the will of the people expressed to the leader through his kind of intimate and close kind of interactions, and I assume a presumption of his unique ability to understand what, in fact, on aggregate, those interests are. Sean, what was your take of the op-ed? Am I overreacting here? It just seemed surprisingly populist and in some ways surprisingly aggressive for a leader in a party so far ahead in the polls. Why take this kind of explicitly populist line to how public policies should be made in Canada?
Yeah, I'll say a few things in response. First, just on your particular point, I think there's something to the concern that you raise. Yes, of course, an elected government need to concern itself with ensuring that on overall terms, its agenda is popular. I mean, in the absence of that, of course, you won't be in government for very long. But I think it's a mistake to start from the premise that every single policy choice you make must be popular. I mean, that can lend itself to a kind of lowest common denominator form of government, which we've seen play out in Ontario over the past, you know, approaching 8 years, and the outcomes are self-evident. You know, Pierre Poilievre has outlined the big challenges facing the country, and the need to have a set of policies that are proportionate to those challenges. I think we just ought need to be clear-minded that not everything that he ought to do or need to do to address those challenges are themselves going to be popular. I mean, you have to take for granted that the totality of your choices and the improvements to Canada's economy are themselves popular rather than individual measures. And so I think in that sense, there's some reason to be alarmed with the framing of the piece. The second criticism I think one could persuasively make is that there is a kind of inherent presumption, Rudyard, to be writing pieces about how you're going to interact with business when you're prime minister before you're prime minister. Notwithstanding the polling, I do think there is a risk that something like this kind of tweaks Canadians to the extent that they say, like, wait a second, buddy, you know, we'll have an election when we have an election. And if our collective wisdom is that you ought to be in 24 Sussex, then that's the call we'll make. But until then, you know, continue to prosecute the case against the government and start to talk about the things you want to do, as opposed to sending a signal to the business community how they're going to interact with your government. The third point I'll make just briefly, and I'd be interested in your reaction to this, notwithstanding those first two points, I do think there is something to the argument he's making here. And I thought I would share a kind of anecdote or story. In the 2015 election campaign, for better or for worse, I was part of the Conservatives' national campaign, and the Trudeau Liberals were rolling out on a daily basis, Rudyard, a series of policies, ideas that whatever one thinks about them were going to conflict with the interests of different businesses or different business groups. And I spent, you know, virtually every day on the phone with these groups to say, like, wait a second, when are you going to lift your head? You know, it's not just that they're not advancing priorities, they're actually proposing ideas that are injurious to the interests of your members. And all of those groups stayed silent. And they now are lying in the bed in a way that they made. And so in the sense that Poilievre's point is there's an obligation on you not just to make big salaries and hang out at fancy dinners in Ottawa and all the rest, and that is kind of an end in itself, that actually your purpose as an advocate for a particular industry or a different particular company or whatever is to actually advance your interests. I think it is a good reminder and a good message to a kind of lobbying class in Ottawa that has grown a bit kind of fat and lazy and complacent over the years, Rudyard. And I suspect that they're hearing that message pretty loud and clear this morning.
I agree with you. Let me just read the two paragraphs in this op-ed that stood out for me the most. So these are the words of Pierre Polyev writing the following. Obviously, my future government will do exactly the opposite of Trudeau on almost every issue, but that does not mean that businesses will get their way. In fact, they will get nothing from me unless they convince the people first. So here is a how-to guide for dealing with a Polyev government. If you do have a policy proposal, don't tell me about it. Convince Canadians it's good for them. Communicate your policy benefits directly to workers, consumers, and retirees. When they start telling me about your ideas on the doorsteps in Windsor, St. John's, Trois-Rivières, and Port Alberni, then I'll think about enacting it. So yes, look, you can have, you know, there's a good faith debate here about, you know, how corporate interests align or not with, you know, the interests of voters, and often they don't. Corporations are, you know, self-seeking, profit-maximizing machines. I guess what kind of causes me to twinge here a little bit is this idea of the people first. As you said, Sean, you know, leadership is often doing things that the people don't want, that they aren't going to want to hear on the doorsteps of Windsor, St. John, Trois-Rivières, and Port Alberni. I mean, think of the GST. You know, the GST is good public policy, not because you're paying more taxes, but because consumption taxes are generally a fairer, more equitable way to distribute tax burdens across society. If you are a people-first politician, there is a real danger, and the Ford government is a case study in this, of a rush to the lowest common denominator, the lowest common ambition when it comes to public policy. So I see a worry here, Sean, on my part. Again, maybe I'm exaggerating this, but a worry between a disjunct between a country that we know and a leader in Pierre Polyev, to his credit, who's really talked about these issues, the big structural challenges facing the Canadian economy, abysmal productivity, abysmal foreign direct investment, declining per capita GDP, out of control migration. The list goes on and on. It is our lost decade thesis that we've been promulgating at the Hub. How the heck do you solve for those types of challenges if you are a people first policy, you know, thinker? I don't know, Sean. This makes me nervous. It makes me think there's a danger here of replicating at the national level the kind of ineptitude and lassitude of the Ford government in Ontario, where you have a big conservative majority and you effectively waste it because every day is the leader trying to divine what, you know, what the people first agenda is, and it's usually something pretty close to the lowest common denominator when it comes to ambition and when it comes to arguably what the people actually need and maybe not want, but is going to be better for them in terms of their long-term outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Let me just elaborate on that, because I think there's a ton of insight there. You know, one issue that we've talked a bit about at the Hub, Rudyard, over time is what's sometimes referred to as the political realignment, which in basic terms means that the center of gravity of conservative politics is shifting. It's increasingly comprises people without post-secondary education, people who work in the goods-producing economy, not the knowledge economy, people who live in rural and peripheral communities as opposed to cities, et cetera, et cetera. That process has really been ongoing for some time, but it's clearly accelerated in the past several years. And I think one inherent challenge, just to sort of build on your comments, is that the new center of gravity in conservative politics isn't socialistic by any means, but it's not, it doesn't see in business a partner or an ally or whatever. And the challenge, of course, is, as you say, when you look at the big economic challenges facing the country, what it's going to require is a pretty conventional small C conservative economic orthodoxy, a kind of supply side agenda to boost investment, to boost growth, to unleash the animal spirits. I think of things like tax cuts on capital or deregulation or liberalizing foreign ownership restrictions and on and on and on. So I do think there may be a disjunction between the center of gravity of conservative politics, this sort of people first politics that you mentioned, and the actual types of policies that are responsive to the set of economic challenges that, as you say, Pierre Polyev has so articulately set out before Canadians. And so I think one challenge that he's going to have to face is, what are the types of things that he can do that speak to sort of people first politics that purchase him the social license, the political license, to undertake some of these big structural policies that we're talking about? If he fails to do that, the risk is, as you say, this sort of devolves into a lowest common denominator government, and it becomes a squandered opportunity, a missed opportunity to undertake those big challenges to make sure we avert a second lost decade. I hope that's something that him and his team are thinking about. If I can, I'll turn it to you in a second, but maybe just to be concrete about this, I think in hindsight, an underappreciated point of the Harper years is that the GST tax cut, whatever one thinks about it, and economists, you know, some economists were critical, et cetera, et cetera. I think as a kind of matter of political economy, it created the conditions which allowed the Harper government to lower corporate taxes from 22 to 15%, to advance a pretty ambitious free trade agreement, to do the kind of conventional economic orthodoxy in his policies that he did. And so if I was Pierre Polyev, I would be thinking about, what are those types of people-first policies that become the key to unlock the kind of supply-side agenda that Canada so desperately needs?
Well, push on. Let's follow this, because, you know, as we've discussed a lot of the Hub, you know, there are real tensions between conservatism in its various forms and populism. And it's a fascinating moment. I mean, we are in a populist moment right now. And, you know, the future of conservatism, how it responds to these big, big challenges, you know, it has some muscle memory about how we've done this in the past and how successful prime ministers like Brian Mulroney, and I would add Jean Chrétien to that list, you know, responded to real, really kind of profound structural issues. We have not had a test of populism in the face of these types of seemingly intractable, high stakes issues that are facing the country right now. And again, I don't want to beat up too much on the situation in Ontario, but it's where I live, and I see what's happening here every day, and I just think demonstrably, you know, if you add in the infrastructure investments, you know, a $20 billion plus deficit this year in Ontario alone, you know, we are not seeing many compelling or interesting answers coming out of, you know, a populist Ford government as to how to address, you know, the big and serious challenges facing Ontario. So let's continue to watch this space. But as always, great to catch up with you. And, I want some optimism, Sean. I want you to channel some deep optimism about the Leafs, what's going to happen in Game 7. You're already, you know, counting on the Panthers, you know, taking us out of contention to break the curse. I'm just not going to accept it, Sean. I'm going to drag you over into the happy camp of Johnny come lately Leaf fans like me that don't have all the scar tissue and trauma clearly that you've developed over years of watching your favorite team.
Well, I'll text you during the game on Saturday, and we'll see if you have the same optimism that you have today.
Okay, be well. Thank you for listening to the Hub Roundtable. If you're looking for great daily analysis and insights on the issues driving the public conversation, check out thehub.ca. Our website gives you access to all the Hub's original news reporting and the thinking of our best writers, including Sean Spear and yours truly, Rudyard Griffiths. While you're on the hub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you'll receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was. The Hub Roundtable is produced and edited by Amal Atter Guzman. Thank you for listening.